Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent challenge to share with you. This podcast is brought to you by the Ministry of Premier Insight. And on June 30th, we come to the end of our financial year. The challenge we face is there is a final funding gap of $65,000 that must be closed by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help meet this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're very pleased to say we're having a guest on the show again today. Welcoming back for her second appearance is Dawn McAvoy. Hi, Dawn.
Hello. Good to see you both.
We had you on, what was it, about a few months ago. I can't remember. Talking about contraception. It was very interesting. Do go back and find that episode. But slightly different topic today, Dawn. A bit more with your kind of work hat on. Could you just briefly introduce yourself for those who haven't come across you before? What do you do?
Hi, yes, thank you. I lead the Both Lives Initiative, which is a part of the Evangelical Alliance. We were founded in 2017 in Northern Ireland as Both Lives Matter. And at that point, we're specifically focused on what was happening in Northern Ireland. Now we sit with a UK-wide perspective and speak into the areas of public policy, advocacy and service provision in the to do with the issues of abortion and pregnancy crisis across the United Kingdom.
Brilliant. Well, we're really pleased to have you to discuss what has been quite a big story here in the kind of ethics, medical, Christian world in the UK, which lots of listeners will be aware of, which is that just last week, as we record this, an amendment was passed by the House of Commons after just less than an hour of debate, tacked onto a kind of unrelated bill, which would decriminalise abortion up to term. We're going to explain in detail about what exactly that means, because that's a slightly unfamiliar idea to lots of people. But before we do that, shall we just quickly set the scene for how abortion law works in the UK, which began in 1967 with the Abortion Act?
Just before we go there, I was fascinated to see, because actually last week two momentous landmark medical ethics things happened in Parliament. One was this, which is a huge change in the law with unforeseeable consequences. And the second was the so-called assisted dying bill, which was about assisted suicide, which was also passed by Parliament with unforeseeable consequences. But the contrast between the two is very striking.
Yes.
Because the assisted dying bill has been debated enormously, has had a huge amount of coverage, great deal of concern, a lot of public interest, letters to Parliament, all kinds of things going on, a long, protracted Parliament committee stage, and then finally the vote and all the debate and all the rest. In contrast, this is tacked on as an amendment to another bill. There's been no serious discussion, no serious debate, not really any public interest. And it's happened. And apart from the usual suspects, so yes, the abortion providers go on and say this is a wonderful advance, and some of the pro-life groups say this is absolutely terrible, and then we move on. And so I'm just interested in that, just as a backdrop. Why is this of such little interest to the British public and to the media?
I think that's very pertinent to all of this. And actually, coming from Northern Ireland, I suppose it gives you a slightly different perspective, because we didn't change the law in 1967 as England, Scotland and Wales did, to legalise abortion. So abortion in Northern Ireland, I suppose, putting it in a really, summarising it, was legal and safe, but very rare because it was significantly restricted. So we would have, from the island of Ireland, north and south, looked across to Great Britain, slightly in horror at the way in which abortion had become so normal and commonplace. We would have seen the silence, really, from society, with a resistance to engage, possibly a resistance based on a perception of how things were done in America, which I think can become, there is some truth in criticism of maybe extreme pro-life voices, but I would actually defend a lot of what was done because it kept the issue live across society, whereas in the UK, because it's funded by the taxpayer, provided by the NHS, I think across the context of over 50 years, it had become settled. That was what we kept hearing. This is settled. There's a status quo that was meaning people weren't talking about it or engaging with it, and for the most part had no idea what was happening. They didn't know what the law said and they didn't know how it was being applied, apart from those who were particularly engaged. And there were voices, obviously, that were speaking out. And then fast forward to 2025 and what's just happened. It's nearly like people's eyes have been opened and they're shocked. How could this have happened whenever those of us who were engaged could see the activism, could see the trajectory, and were expecting an amendment to be tabled to a seemingly unrelated bill, because that had, of course, happened for Northern Ireland a few years previously. So the cultural acceptance of abortion as healthcare, I think, and the resistance to talk about it enabled what happened to happen.
It strikes me from the outside that the assisted dying, even its proponents, again, there's been a long campaign, goes back a century in this country, to try and legalize some form of euthanasia. But even the people lobbying for this would be happy to acknowledge this as a big kind of social shift. This is a big change. In fact, sometimes they celebrate this as a kind of march forward for progress. Whereas, as you say, ever since 67, and certainly in my lifetime, the last 30 or 40 years, abortion has been very deliberately kind of depoliticized and said, this is a non-issue. This, as you say, it's a settled issue. We don't, thank the Lord, have the culture wars that we have in the States over it. It just happens. It's properly regulated. It's properly funded. It's done all by professionals. Don't worry a little head about it. All the political parties are of one voice, bar a few outliers. And so it very much was taken off the kind of realm of public debate and put into the purely, it's about policy delivery. It's just about tidying up. And that was how, to jump to the end, as I would argue that some of the more radical pro-choice parts of the pro-choice movement who want full decriminalization have been able to kind of smuggle this in, is because they've effectively said, look, we're not doing a big public debate. We've already had that debate in 67. This is just about tidying up some loose ends, you know, getting rid of that terrible Victorian archaic legislation, all that stuff. And a lot of people, including a lot of Christians, have been basically, you know, had their eyes shut and haven't really been aware of the radical nature of what has been passed.
I think that's true. And I think also, you know, having worked in the NHS for many years, I know that if you were to raise the issue of abortion, it was regarded not only as settled, but also as sort of deeply impolite or insensitive to raise it. And if you had the effrontery to raise a question about abortion, it was often met with sort of eye rolling. Oh, well, here we go again. You know, here's the old,
fundamentalists.
The religious lot have got to have their little bit, so that, you know, and let them get on with it. Meanwhile, we just carry on. So it is an extraordinary contrast with the States. I mean, which is where abortion is one of the defining issues, isn't it, of the culture wars, of politics. It's one of the main issues on which the Republican Party has always, for the last decades, presented itself. So it's a fascinating thing. And of course, this is why comparing what's happening in the States to what's happening here is just deeply unhelpful. I mean, and we are much more European in this sense, but even with compared to most Europeans, we are far more liberal small L.
I think, albeit I know we're going to talk about the law that was changed in Northern Ireland, but I think it would have been much more helpful and still is to reflect on, even within the four nations of the United Kingdom, the difference that law makes on culture and practice, legal and medical, and also in society. So Northern Ireland, I think, was a perfect test case for the impact of law change and what that means, and the efficiency or effectiveness of law on protecting lives. And when we launched our campaign as Both Lives Matter in 2017, it was with a report to say that those more restrictive abortion laws had led to 100,000 lives being lived who would otherwise have been aborted if legislation in support of abortion had changed in 67 in Northern Ireland, as it did in England, Scotland and Wales. Now, we put billboards up to say that, and launched with a report. I think 14 complaints were received by the Advertising Standards Agency, and then they investigated our methodology and upheld the claim. So in summary, we then were able to say that it was a pro-abortion myth that laws don't make a difference, that laws restricting abortion don't stop abortion, they just make it less safe. We were able to show that laws restricting abortion do work, lives are lived and are born, but also women weren't dying in the context of unsafe illegal abortions, and additionally women weren't in prison languishing. That was the image that was being painted, that in Northern Ireland women were suffering, dying from backstreet abortions and being imprisoned. None of that was the case. So we don't have to look to America or even elsewhere in Europe to see the impact of different laws.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, isn't it? I suppose I might gently push back a bit because, you know, for us on this bit of the water, Northern Ireland sometimes seems like a foreign land in terms of culture. You know, it has a very deeply rooted culture, which goes back hundreds of years. So there is always a very close interface between law and culture, and I think it's a combination of both. It is, I'm sure you're right, that if the 1967 Act had been adopted in Northern Ireland, the abortion figures would have been greater. But I find it hard to believe that the same kind of liberalism that swept through the UK would have swept through Northern Ireland. But it's an impossible question to answer, isn't it? But I think the fundamental story must be true. The laws do save lives, and it's certainly true that this myth that horrific suffering of women result is false.
And even if you can't go back and see what would happen if things had looked different, but we can always say law shapes culture. So even at that point, we can see that in GB, England, Scotland and Wales, after nearly 60 years of abortion rates are the highest ever recorded.
That's
the
true.
Most recent year that hasn't been released yet, but predictions are that abortion could be as high as 300,000 abortions. The 2022-23 figures tell us that we're at 250,000 already.
Yeah.
So it is significantly different to where it started. So at the very least, we can say permitting it in law enables it, you know, so laws matter in principle and practice.
Definitely. I mean, the other complicating factor for the Northern Irish case, and indeed for the Republic of Ireland, is that, as every woman knows, there is a short boat ride over the water to a country very close where they speak the same language and where you can access an abortion. And I'm not suggesting for a second that every single woman who was having an abortion in in Ireland, north or south now, would have automatically taken the chip, because obviously it costs money and it's whatever. But it has always been a kind of hole in the firewall, hasn't it? That it has been very straightforward and is commonplace in many parts of Irish culture, north and south, for women to take a ferry ride over the sea to England if they do need an abortion. But anyway, we should wind the clock back and do it. That's a kind of extended preamble. Let's talk a little bit about, we can't understand what decriminalization means without understanding what exactly the legal situation is for abortion in England and Wales, we're talking about in particular with this amendment. And what people may not understand, a lot of people think, well, the 1967 Abortion Act just legalized abortion, but it's actually strictly not the case. Abortion remains a criminal offense dating to the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act. But what the Abortion Act did was create exceptions within certain parameters.
Yes. So if I just take up the story here. So the abortion was made illegal. Procuring an abortion was made illegal back in the Victorian era. And certainly in medical ethics, it was regarded as a complete no-no for registered medical practitioners, and they could face imprisonment. And in fact, I remember when I first started as a medical student, and this is back in the 1970s, we had one lecture on medical ethics, and I was taught that all the things that you shouldn't do began with A, and one of them was abortion. The others were alcoholism, advertising. I can't remember what the others were.
But assisted suicide.
Probably is. But anyway, so there was...
isn't it in the Hippocratic Oath? It goes back a long way, doesn't it?
It does, absolutely. And certainly there was a kind of a universal view that this was an abuse of medical skill to procure an abortion. But then there was a backstreet industry where abortion could be procured, and usually by older women who had developed techniques for procuring abortions. And again, of course, that has been known right through to the ancient world. There were also a few notorious cases where I think one case in particular, Dawn may have more of the details, where a woman had been raped and became pregnant, and a prominent doctor performed an abortion.
I think it was she was a teenager. I think a very young, actually, and it was from memory a gang rape. I think British soldiers. So yes, Dr. Bourne then performed an abortion. Yeah.
And it was almost daring the authorities to prosecute him in such an extreme circumstance. And therefore that there was a kind of legal precedent that under certain extreme cases, doctors could perform abortions and would not be prosecuted. But there were also tragic cases where women suffered very severely as a result of an illegal abortion. And I think I may have told this story before, but it's a very striking one. I remember speaking to my elderly relative who had been a GP in the pre-Abortion Act era. And he described having a house call to one of his patients who was a teenage girl or maybe a young 20s. And he described walking into the home up to her bedroom and finding the dead body of this woman with blood everywhere. And it was apparent it was a botched abortion. And it was when I spoke to him about this incident, and he was describing this incident 50 years previously, his eyes filled with tears. And it was obvious that though it had made a huge impression on him, and it made a huge impression on, even though those cases were relatively rare, they clearly made a huge impression on the Christian medical profession, and particularly GPs who were involved, which is why in the 1967, which was one of the first abortion acts in the world, which said that if it was framed entirely in terms of medical paternalism, two doctors decide on medical grounds that the risks of continuing the pregnancy were greater than the risks of performing an abortion. It was entirely a medical decision. And they could then avoid being prosecuted under the 1860s Act. So, and it was, there was a lot of controversy at the time. Many Christians, including, I think, particularly Catholics and Catholic doctors, were appalled at this change in the law. But I know that a significant number of Protestant doctors, including evangelicals, actually at the time saw this as a positive development. And the analogy they used was the divorce law reform. They said, yes, this is a terrible situation, but because of human brokenness, because of human sin, this was, quotes, the lesser of two evils. So that was the 1967 Act. And of course, at the time, it was anticipated that the numbers would be very small. There were estimates made about the number of people, women who were dying as a result of illegal abortions. Although wildly different numbers were circulated, but I think a detailed review came to the conclusion that the numbers were relatively small. I mean, still, of course, tragic and significant, but it wasn't true to say that thousands and thousands of women were dying.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is part of the Ministry of Premier Insight. And as we close out our financial year, we've been offered a $10,000 matching grant that will double your gift today. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as we're needing $65,000 before the end of our financial year on June 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now to meet this $65,000 need, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And the people who, many of those who passed, who voted in favour of the law in 67, are on record saying that they, as you say, they did it as a kind of compassionate humanitarian act to spare these small number of women extreme suffering, which is why if you look at the reasons why an abortion can be, you know, gives you the doctors the defense against the 1861 Act that criminalizes it, they're quite narrowly written in the sense of, you know, it's the health of the mother would be damaged by the pregnancy considering and things like that. But And none of them really, am I right in saying, had any intention or desire to create a kind of on-demand abortion regime. It was very much seen as this kind of, this will be for a small number of people who the doctors agree, you know, really can't go forward with the pregnancy.
That's right. In fact, I've just found the figures from a 1966 report from the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which concluded that the annual number of abortions, so this is just before legalization, was about 14,000. And the number of maternal deaths in 66 were approximately 30. Hmm. So nobody anticipated. It was thought that this would just legalizing what was already happening. But of course, what then turned out was something, you know, dramatically very different. That there was really a very rapid rise over the first few years.
Yeah. And I suppose, I mean, to be fair to past generations, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And from a both lives perspective, which acknowledges that there are always at least two lives in existence in every pregnancy, and we would say that both lives matter, then for us, it's all about the why. So actually thinking about abortion law and looking at those stats and figures, recognizing that law shapes culture, I can remember doing a bit of research. Well, why was abortion legislation originally brought in the late 1800s? You know, what was the context of criminalizing it? And I remember finding a quote that talked about an epidemic of infanticide and child murder, and child murder referred to abortion. And the Offences Against the Person Act was a desire to respond to those rates of abortion. And there was a, not in the sense that we would recognise now of like a welfare state, but there was an attempt to provide for primarily single women, because it was recognised that that was the case. It was babies maybe out of wedlock. So there was a desire to respond to both lives, maybe in a way that we wouldn't like the language or the structure. And then, of course, it was extended in 67 again, a desire to respond in a way that provided compassion. And now in 2025, again, we see this desire to respond with compassion. But again, from our perspective, I would say, you know, the law on its own is never enough. Saying no to abortion in law is the right thing in principle, in the sense of abortion on demand or on request based on social reasons, because the trajectory of that is the complete dehumanization of the unborn child. But it's not enough to say no in law. You have to provide those social support structures and the service provision that will enable women to choose life. Because when we look at the statistics, we can see the vast majority of abortions aren't for reasons of life or health risk. They are socioeconomic circumstances and a lack of material, practical, emotional supports. So the law does matter, but services and culture matter just as much.
Yeah. So just to continue the historical story then. So in 1967, Parliament was really making it up as they went along. You know, there was no really predecessor abortion legislation. And so they decided that abortion would be legal, but only if doctors agreed on the risk basis, up to 28 weeks. And they took 28 weeks basically as the point at which it was possible for a child to survive. And it's very clear that they initially intended there to be, as it has been put, clear blue water between the stage of gestation in which abortion could be carried out and the stage at which a child could be kept alive, because Parliament recognised that if you had an overlap between those two, you would cause problems. And so 28 weeks was taken as the limit at which was, at the time, it was very unusual for premature babies to survive beyond 28 weeks. But then what happened is, with advances in neonatology, in my own particular field, we were looking after babies who were surviving at 24 weeks, even 23 weeks. And so in 1990, the Abortion Act was amended, and two major changes were. The first was that there was a reduction from 28 to 24 weeks, because at 24 weeks represented at that time pretty well the limits at which babies could survive. But another critical amendment was made, and that was in cases of either where the mother's life was at risk or where there was a risk that a child, as it was in the wording of the law, that if it might survive, would be, quote, severely handicapped, that abortion could be carried out at any stage up until term.
And that was new. That didn't exist, that second provision about carrying out late-term abortions.
Absolutely.
If the child was going to be disabled, didn't exist in 67.
Well, it only allowed up to 28 weeks. The 28 weeks was the absolute cutoff that Parliament had wished. And so in 1990, they already created this bizarre circumstance where at one and the same time you could be possibly saving children and yet you could be deliberately killing a more mature fetus. And I've described this as a scene going on in my own hospital, where I was working in the neonatal intensive care unit, and we were, you know, pouring enormous resources and time and energy desperately trying to keep vulnerable little babies alive. right down to 24, 23 weeks of gestation. And in one floor above, sophisticated medical procedures were being called intending to destroy the life of a fetus who was considerably bigger and stronger, but who usually had some kind of congenital abnormality. So even in 1990, there was a weird kind of mismatch being created. And often we as health professionals on both sides, you know, felt this weird kind of trying to get your head around it. You know, what does society want? Does society want us to keep these babies alive and values the life of these babies? Or does society think they're disposable? And of course, what was the difference? The difference was the babies in the neonatal in the unit were, quotes, wanted. And even though they may have had a significant risk of disability, handicap, or whatever, and of course the babies had rights. Once a baby was born, even at 24 weeks, they have full human rights. They are protected by a panoply of national and international legislation, which says you have to act in their own interest, even if you know they're going to be disabled. Whereas in the other clinic, the fetus has no rights, and basically the parents have come to the conclusion, sadly, you know, and often very painfully and with a great deal of distress, that the right thing to do was to take the life of the fetus.
And what was particularly jarring is that at that time in the 1990s, the kind of disability rights movement is gathering pace, and there's a growing social awareness of the ways in which disabled people are excluded. And, you know, laws were changing to mandate more better access and inclusion in education and in business. And yet we are also baking into our laws a clear example of discrimination, which is that if you're an able-bodied fetus, the cutoff is 24 weeks. But if you are disabled, your parents can abort you up to 39 weeks and 6 days and 23 hours, which was rarely remarked upon until more recent, when there's been a few court cases kind of probing at that as that kind of example. But it is a kind of prima facie piece of discrimination against the disabled written into our statute.
It is. And yet, I've had many conversations and debates with medical ethicists and pro-abortion activists and philosophers who can't see the problem. We are totally for disability rights, and we're totally for liberal abortion. And the point is, their argument is that life starts at birth. Your rights start at birth. You know, from the moment you're born, we're going to protect you, Tim. We're going to do everything for you. We're here for you to protect you. But unfortunately, until you're born, you have no protection at all.
And yet international and national law does recognise to different degrees life before birth. The preamble to the Declaration on the Rights of the Child talks about because of their immaturity and vulnerability, they deserve appropriate legal protection before as well as after birth. And of course, again, going back to where, you know, you were talking about disability discrimination, that's where abortion is probably most obviously discriminatory in practice. Disabled babies, ill babies are disproportionately more likely to be terminated. But abortion is also inherently discriminatory in financial circumstances, because you're 2 to 3 times more likely to have a termination if you live in the most deprived area compared to the least. It's also discriminatory in the context of the age and stage of a woman. You know, the age that is most at risk of choosing abortion, in quotes, is a woman in her early 20s who is primarily single. 83% of abortions are for women whose marital status is single. So if you're disabled and unborn, or if you are the woman and you are younger and single and not financially stable, you're most at risk of abortion in the context of not having the support network. And I suppose that's where I would see the parallel with the assisted dying conversation, that we don't actually live in a system that offers equally valid choices. That's not what we're talking about. Do you know, for people going back to disability, friends, or, I mean, you'll know way more, I'm sure, than me across the years of your practice in medicine. But if families who receive the context of a diagnosis for a preborn baby felt that they had the supports available post-birth, how much more would they be feeling that they could continue in the pregnancy? So we don't live, I don't think, in a system of choice in the way that we think we do.
I think that's right. And just to sort of sidestep just briefly into the kind of philosophy, this is the problem with the concept of autonomy. You know, the idea that I am this individual, this soul being, and I just choose the right course for my life. I mean, it's utterly absurd understanding of what it means to be human. The fact that we are all locked into, by creation, we're locked into these web of relationships and dependencies, and we're so much influenced by others, and we depend on others. So this idea of the woman, the pregnant woman, as this solitary monad, to use this technical term, you know, who is just steering their own course, making their sovereign choices, I'm afraid it's an utter absurdity. And yet it's a very powerful myth that, and of course it's not all false, it's a half truth. We believe in freedom. We believe passionately that coercion, coercive control, manipulation, abuse, all these things are evil. Human beings deserve freedom, but it's freedom within the context of the creation that God has given us.
And it's freedom within the context of being mindful of our responsibility towards others. And even, I mean, the language of my body, my choice, that implies that autonomous being and that freely made decision within the context of an abortion system, where I think it is fair to question the information that women are being given. Is it truly informed consent? Whenever a lot of women who have shared their abortion stories with us didn't fully appreciate either the stage of pregnancy that they were at, or indeed what the abortion was and the impact that it would have on them, the regret and the pain that many of them talk about. Also in the context of families, putting that maybe with the best of intention, a perception of pressure, even if we can't use the word coercion in most of those cases. And also then, of course, there are cases of coercion. Again, you have to question this idea that abortion decisions are being freely made by the majority of women.
Yes, I'm aware time is passing and we haven't really got to dehumanisation yet. So let's skip forward to the year 2019, Dawn, which kind of laid a lot of the groundwork for what happened last week in the UK Parliament, which was in the context. So as we explained, the 67 Act was not extended to Northern Ireland, given that anti-abortion was probably one of the only things at the time the two communities in Northern Ireland agreed on, both Catholics, Protestants, you know, Unionists and Republicans. They were all pretty much united in being hostile to this. So that was not extended to Northern Ireland until 2019. But again, the way that abortion was introduced in Northern Ireland is very interesting. It came in the context of when the local Northern Irish Parliament, the Assembly, was kind of deadlocked or not in operation because the parties couldn't agree over something. I've actually forgotten what they fell out.
It had actually collapsed. Yeah, local government had collapsed.
It collapsed. That's right. And so effectively, the UK Parliament was kind of ruling Northern Ireland directly while they were trying to restore power sharing local government. And they were extending the deadline to try and restore the Northern Irish Executive when some MPs added a cheeky amendment to that act. Can you just explain what that amendment did and what the impact of it was in Northern Ireland?
Yes, and I do just want to say all of the previous discussion bears context, and it is appropriate in the degree to which I think it lays out the groundwork for them what happened. There was a perception of expectation that this is healthcare, that women in Northern Ireland need this because this is what we have, and there were no questions around whether it was harmful or not. So at the point in time at which we had no local sitting government in Northern Ireland, abortion activists in politics and medicine and social campaigners decided to take advantage, I would say, of no sitting local government to tag on an amendment to the Northern Ireland Executive Formation Act at Westminster. And that was all about giving civil servants the power to continue governing in the absence of a local sitting assembly. Abortion was a devolved issue across justice and health. And yet Westminster, because of the context of the normalisation and acceptance of abortion as a healthcare and a good, felt that they were well within their rights to come in on a governing bill and impose a new abortion framework on Northern Ireland by decriminalising the law that was in effect in Northern Ireland. So as we said, we didn't have the 67 Act. We had the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act, and that's sections 58 and 59 that have just been talked about last week in Westminster. Those were repealed for Northern Ireland legislation in 2019. So it was no longer a criminal offence to procure or administer an abortion, the woman herself or medics or anyone else. That is different to what happened last week in Westminster, where it was only women were removed from the criminal law. In addition, our equivalent of your Infant Life Preservation Act was repealed, so that extended access to abortion up to birth. And then a health framework was put in place. So there was no criminal law, but a health framework was put in place along the lines of what is known in GB under the 67 Act.
And just explain to us what the reaction was in Northern Ireland to this extraordinary bolt fast, to go from complete effective prohibition to complete and utter decriminalisation.
And I think that's where I'll push back ever so slightly. It wasn't complete prohibition, because we did have, as I said, legal abortions in the context of if there was a risk to life or health or risk to mental or physical health in a way that was deemed real, serious, long-term, permanent. So there was an understanding of abortion being available, but was very restricted. Whenever, as I said, where we started, when we looked across to what was happening in GB, as you said, Tim, Catholic, Protestant, Unionist, Loyalist, Republican, Nationalist, there was pretty much a consensus that we didn't want what was happening in England, Scotland and Wales. There was the recognition that more needed to be done to support women facing pregnancy crisis. But there certainly wasn't a consensus in society or within the political parties to change the law. The most recent vote on abortion had been, I think, 2015-16, and a limited law change had been debated at Stormont, at the local sitting assembly, and had been rejected. But whenever Stormont fell or was collapsed in 2017, I think abortion activists, I would say, in GB, saw their moment to effectively do what they wanted ultimately for Great Britain in Northern Ireland, in the context of many people, including politicians, who didn't fully understand what the law was in Northern Ireland. And I would maybe also suggest we're fed up with Northern Ireland politics and the emotional roller coaster of it all, and felt, and actually one journalist did say to me at the time, well, you couldn't sort yourselves out, one journalist in England, you couldn't sort yourselves out, so we had to do it for you. So it was that sort of context.
Talk about paternalism.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Colonialism.
Colonialism, So I think the response to that, from going from one of the most restrictive legislative places in Europe to one of the most liberal, that introduced decriminalisation and this framework of abortion imposed from Westminster. It was termed at the time as the darkest day by many people. And there was a real lament in the context of church and also wider society. Then, of course, COVID hit in 2020. So it's hard to believe, actually, it was nearly 5 years ago because so much has happened in the meantime. But certainly then what has just happened at Westminster is not a surprise to those of us who saw it happen for Northern Ireland in 2019. And as soon as it happened, the MPs who have introduced it now in Westminster were saying, now we need to have for women in Great Britain what women have in Northern Ireland.
But am I right in saying that in reality, my understanding was there really wasn't any medical facility that was capable of or wished the doctors, none of the doctors in Northern Ireland wished to carry out late abortions or so-called feticides, even though technically it was now legal. So in practice, I understand that people travelled across to GB as they had done before. There wasn't really on the ground a massive change. But is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think it, again, similar to what happened last week in Westminster, although in GB there is a framework within the NHS, people who are raising concerns about lack of scrutiny, lack of appropriate time and process with because it leads to unknown consequences. That was exactly the case. Because then there was just basically seemingly, I'll never forget, it was July, it was the 12th fortnight, our sort of public holidays in Northern Ireland. A lot of people were on holiday when Westminster did what they did and came back from holiday saying, what's just happened? Including civil servants and medics, the whole framework then had to be developed. We've seen spreadsheets, you know, predicting costs and numbers of, you know, staff that are required. The training was required. In England and Wales, it's primarily outsourced by the NHS to abortion providers, BPAS, Mary Stopes. We don't have either of them or any private providers in Northern Ireland, I would say, thankfully. So all of it had to be introduced and implemented within the framework of the NHS without any extra funding, without any consideration as to the who and the how. Westminster had to intervene again because there was such resistance that they could see within the civil service to implement it. There continues to be resistance amongst staff, certainly in the context of second and third trimester abortions. So really it was an activist pursuit of an ideology without the consideration of the impact on the people who would be having to implement it and provide it and perform it.
And again, it's a similar contrast, isn't it, to we talked earlier about the distinction between how decriminalisation of abortion happens versus the very kind of deep, thorough public debate about assisted suicide. But again, if you compare what happened in Northern Ireland in 2019 to the 67 Act, you know, the 1967 Act was, again, a matter of public debate. MPs went through it line by line. It was scrutinised, you know, civil society groups got involved on both sides. And if you're a pro-choice, a pro-abortion activist in the UK who thinks the 67 Act is a great framework, the kind of responsible thing to do would say, well, let's legislate to just include Northern Ireland within the 67 Act. That's a relatively straightforward amendment you could make to the Act. And it is very telling they didn't. They're very telling, as you say, that they waited until the local democratically elected assembly was not sitting, and then they quickly tacked it on to an unrelated piece of legislation and rushed it through without any public debate and didn't consult with the doctors, with the civil servants, with civil society. Instead rushed it through a much more extreme version than we even had here in Great Britain, inevitably leading to calls, you know, you have this almost like continuous perpetual ratchet Northern Ireland doesn't have abortion. They had have what we have here. Let's give them that. Oh, hang on. Northern Ireland has a much more liberal abortion regime. We in GB have to have what they have. And it just kind of bounces across the Irish Sea,
yeah,
getting ever more liberal, ever more permissive either every time.
And I do think it's been really interesting watching the response to last week's events in Westminster, watching the debate in the House of Commons. I was pleasantly surprised by the amount of MPs who spoke in opposition to what was being proposed from across the House. I would say a lot of them, to be fair, wouldn't feel about abortion as I do, but they were at least questioning what was happening on substance and on process, albeit it then passed with a significant majority in the end.
So it turns out that we in Dawn had an awful lot to say about the decriminalisation of abortion. So much, in fact, that we couldn't fit it all onto just one episode. So we are going to have to sadly pause the discussion here for this week. But tune in next Wednesday for the second half of our chat, where we complete the story about how Westminster imposed decriminalisation onto Northern Ireland in 2020, paving the way and setting a crucial precedent for England and Wales to do the same this year. And also the unforeseen role played by the COVID pandemic and the rollout of telemedicine abortions, also known as pills by post. And we also tackle the murky part played in the campaign by the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. It is quite the saga. But we try to end with some thoughts about where the church can go from here in a world where abortion has been effectively legalised all the way to birth.
To Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
O'Reilly Auto Parts puede ayudarte a revisar tu Luz Check Engine, Luz ABS o Luz de Mantenimiento con O'Reilly Veriscan. El servicio es gratis y recibirás un informe con soluciones verificadas por técnicos maestros certificados ASE. Si necesitas ayuda, O'Reilly Auto Parts te puede recomendar un taller. Pregunta por O'Reilly Veriscan hoy mismo. Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.